Okay, so thanks all for coming on this beautiful rainy day. So for those, just to see how, okay. For those who don't know me, I'm Tatiana Petro. I'm a junior professor in the computer science department, and I'm one of the PIs in our collective behavior cluster. And since I knew that the audience will be a bit diverse, so I will give a bit broader background into how I, as a computer scientist, fit in this story. And then I will concretely talk about some recent works, actually very recent, the work that was presented just in April at the conference, at the workshop that was joined to the ETAPS conference, one of the main conferences for a theory and practice of software. So I was told I have half an hour. I'll try to keep to that frame and then we can discuss. Okay, so I think I don't need to introduce much this slide. So we have collective behavior we find it in nature. Also, we can be one of the forming bodies of collective behavior. It is characterized by many individuals who are communicating within a network. And the fascinating things about collective behavior is the emergent properties. So when a group of individuals is together, when they can do things that are beyond the capabilities of an individual alone, or there could be also some bad things happening, like a traffic jam, for example, or in a cell, if something goes wrong in a signal transduction, then we get sick. So we want to ask, what are the mechanisms that underlie these groupings and that give rise to these emergent behaviors? So we are actually at a good historical point, we could say, because technology is very powerful and we are having more and more measurement opportunities and measurement possibilities, so which is an opportunity to find answers to our questions. And also, on the other hand, we have mature mathematical theories and very powerful computers that can crunch our data and simulate our hypothesis. And we actually, with the growing body of data, not everything is solved because data is not knowledge, and we actually need to systematically integrate the growing body of data towards unraveling the underlying principles. This is just an interesting graph showing how the price of genome sequencing dropped, but the price of humans analyzing this data cannot drop, actually. So this is a very common slide for me to put these elephants, where on one hand we have a model of an elephant, and on the other hand it's the data. So it's to separate this notion of what we see and with our experiments and what is our abstract representation of what we see. And when we talk about the collective behavior, we have to also have these notions of how a group of individuals, how a group of individuals forms a collective, or how a collective will be consisted of individuals. And we can also abstractly think of many layers in between. And also the data we can obtain at different levels of abstraction. And this is a very challenging task because the data, the actual systems we model have many dimensions, so spatial, temporal, environments are uncertain, so the individuals can be very complex, so cognitive, they can make decisions in complex ways, and so on. So what can we do about this when the dependencies propagate over time and space, and maybe there is also memory in these groups? So what I do as a computer scientist, actually I take inspiration from what we new informal verification. So what could be comparably challenging to these biological systems that we want to model is actually, I would say, software. So for example, when we think about just 10 megabytes of memory, that is the number of states that can be observed there is bigger than the number of atoms in the universe. And as we all know, software is buggy. So those could be some bugs that are not very harmful, just annoying. But there could be critical bugs, like maybe some of you heard of the case of Toyota unintended acceleration, that after years of lawsuits and lots of fines and jury awards, it is most probable that it's a software fault. So not today, actually, one can see the final report from the two researchers who were analyzing what actually happened there. And of course, if we use software in medical domain or for security, it is very sensitive and can cost a lot, either lives or money. And it's actually not getting better, it's getting worse with time. If we look at our modern cars, this is, I think, from 2016, it's millions, hundreds of millions of software code that are in our cars. And verification is actually an idea to formally verify our software. So to say, if we have an input, some program, and a specification, we want to build another program that will verify whether the specification is met or some requirements. And so hopefully we get the answer, yes, your software is safe, so you can drive in that car or in that airplane or not. But this is an impossible dream because in general, this is an undecidable problem. But what happened is if we specify the program in a formal language, so in order to at all have this well-defined, we need to deal with some formally defined structures. So we need a formal model and a specification expressed as a formal property. And then we could do something. So in general, it's not decidable, but we could do something. And over the last 50 years, there has been a range of tools and theories that support these queries, such as, for example, temporal logic, model checking, theorem provers, abstract interpretation, static analysis. So I put the first three here on the list are the three things we used in the work that I will show in the second part of the talk. And actually, things are really not getting better before they're getting worse, because we are seeing the future of smart cities, of self-driving cars. And actually, soon we may have the situation that in the way that we are now studying the biological collective systems, we will have to study the collective behavior of robots. And when we will have these systems, it will be even more important to have guarantees on them, that they would be predictable and that they would be integrated. And especially in these domains, when all these objects function in uncertain environments, as is the case exactly with our animals, so it also in this case when we will have one day smart cities, it is very important to talk about probabilities. So we won't have just a yes or no answer. It will be a yes or no answer, but the question will be, is the probability of failure smaller than 0.05%, if that is what we want to be guaranteed. And that big picture of a program and a specification and the answer that gives us yes or no now becomes a system that may be this actually collective system of possibly robots or animals or cyber-physical system like us interacting with our car. And there we call this a probabilistic verifier that will give us answers about the probabilistic queries. And so the answer can be yes or no, but we also want to maybe have some quantitative results or maybe some strategy if it's the problem at hand is a game. So the strategy could be how to reach some goal point in space. So our approach is actually, as I mentioned already, to combine these techniques of formal verification and automated reasoning and mathematical modeling, so to aid our understanding of biological systems. And there the data becomes, the property becomes something we extract from data. So those are the constraints that we give to the problem, and the model is typically some kind of automata that you can enrich in many different ways by defining a different notion of time, different notion of transition, possibly rewards, and so on. So now I will tell about this concrete work that was inspired, actually, we will have later on that where it was inspired from. So here we actually do parameter synthesis. So it's a concrete instance of this high-level framework that I just presented. So the input, or what we have, let's say, on a computer or in silico, would be a population Markov chain that is actually a composition of n identical agents. And here the distinctive thing is that we keep it parametric. So it's a chain defined over some variables. So we don't give concrete numbers yet, because maybe we just don't know about them, or we want to, in this special case, we actually want to learn them. And we will input the constraints from the data. And on the other hand, we have data, and we will extract properties from data. And concretely, in this case, we have steady state properties. And as you know, as the biology part of the audience knows, sometimes it's possible only to obtain the steady state measurements. And in the temporal logic, we can call this, this is FG, it stands for finally globally. It means that it's a steady state. So we can express any formula here that is atomic proposition. It could be some atomic property, like some value, for example, in a certain range. And temporally, we also can say that some value will be in the certain range at when the system reaches the steady state. And this actually stems from this verification community when people were trying to prove that, for example, a concurrent program doesn't have a deadlock, or that there wouldn't be a starvation problem. And the parameter synthesis finds the subset of parameters, so that this would be the full parameter space, so the domain of the variables, and this is the number of variables, such that whenever a point is in this set that we are searching for, which is the green area here, then the property, when we instantiate our model with that parameter point, the property will hold, and vice versa. So it's a full exact characterization of the set of parameters that we call viable parameter space, where the property holds. And now here, I think it's a good point to mention how this is different than standard parameter estimation or parameter inference. So the major difference is that with parameter estimation or inference, like you say, okay, I could use maximum likelihood principle, or I could use regression with respect to least squared methods. Those methods will give you one point that is minimizing or maximizing some objective function. Well, in this method, we actually have the full space of parameters where the property holds. And all the approximation or assumption we are making about the system is made in this step when we extract the property from data. And as we will see in our examples, we will extract the property subject to some level of confidence, like 95 confidence level, because it's data, so we are taking some statistics from it. But then our approximations stop. And concretely, so let's see this example. And actually, this is our working example in the paper, because as soon as it gets slightly more complicated, it gets challenging computationally. So I first give some just a basic example that everybody has seen. It's a Bernoulli variable. This one here, rule one, where the blue ball can turn into what we call a success, labeled with one, or a failure, labeled with zero. And it is a success with probability p. And this is like everybody heard about this. So we have a population state that in this case, let's say we start with five neutral balls, and then and at one step, we have to decide now whether the update will be synchronous or asynchronous, or there would be some special scheduling at the update. But let's say, let's assume it's just synchronous. So we will have some probability that, that this happens, so that we have three successes in this first and actually only step. And then when we have data, we are doing statistics, so we repeat the experiment. So in one experiment, we get three successes, then we have two successes, so we are filling in the histogram in the data, and so on. So then we have again two successes. So in this basic example, what one can say in a frequentist way from this data, depending on the number of samples that in experiments that in this case is 100, we can say with 95% confidence the correct p is in some interval. It is the confidence interval. And so there may be a debate how exactly to compute this, and the Bayesians don't like it. But we will see later on how we use it. And now there is a more complex case that where we have a rule two as well. So first there is a synchronous update that is just this Bernoulli trial. And then the rule two is context dependent. So if there are I successes, then there is I successes around the agent, then he has a second chance to succeed. So there is no immediate distribution among successful or failed agents. But the ones who succeed, they succeeded. But then the remaining ones, that are the light green ones, they have a second chance. And the second chance is there only if there are successful agents around them. And depending on the number of successful agents around them, so here we have the rule. So depending on I, the probability of turning to success will change. And as we will see later, that is actually the research question that motivated all this model. And so we can also write expressions for what is the probability of moving from this initial state to this choice with three successes. So that will be just a binomial distribution. And then we can execute the second rule as long as it is possible. So as long as there are some remaining light green agents. And here we define this update to be asynchronous because it was more realistic with respect to the phenomena we had in mind. But also it is possible to consider other kinds of also synchronous update or scheduled one. And about the logic that I was mentioning before, so this is to show how this would look like, the probability that finally, globally, we end up with four successes for a system with parameters p, and other parameters are q of 1, q of 2, q of 3, and so on, because q depends, q has the parameter. So for n agents initially, there would be n minus 1 values for q. So here we could say that probability of finally globally being in state 4 is the product of these probabilities on the transitions that are shown here. But there may be alternative ways also to reach to this final state. Because if initially there were four successes, for example, then we could directly go to this state here and so on. So there's some branching. So what can we say about the function qi for different population sizes if we have the measurements available only at the steady state? And if someone is familiar with biochemical kinetics, this would actually mean seeing what is the... So in biochemical kinetics, we often assume the mass action law, which means that this q of I is linear. So that is directly proportional to the number of particles that are on the left-hand side of the reaction. But here, this is exactly what we want to find out. And this is what Morgan actually asked in her... She wanted to to discover from the steady state measurements what is the social feedback in honeybees. Because one can observe that there is the tension between the amount of pheromone that is currently in the hive, which promotes aggressiveness, but on the other hand, since the bees die after stinging, then there seems to be some social feedback that also regulates that the whole colony doesn't go extinct. So in our model, one can this success state actually means that the bee has stung and dies. And the fact that there could be a conversion is related to the amount of pheromone that the bees who sting emit. So yeah, this is what I was just formulating. How is stinging behavior regulated so that we have an efficient defense with the limited workers' loss? So the algorithm we used has this specification. The input is the population size, the parameter coverage that I will now explain, and the property that we extract from data for some desired confidence. This property is phi. And our output is this coloring that has green, red, and white regions. And our output will be such, it's actually partitioning of the full parameter space into three regions, and such that whenever a point is colored green, then we know that the property is met. Whenever the point is colored red, then the property doesn't hold for sure. And for the white points, we don't know. And the coverage is the amount of points for which we know what they are with respect to property phi. So, which means the ratio of the total, the size of green and red region together divided by the full parameter space. So, we want to have coverage as large as possible. So, the steps of the algorithm are as follows. First step is encoding the property, and as we will see in a moment, we encode data as a conjunction of persistency properties. Persistency are these finally globally properties. And we will treat each of the outcomes of this final distribution as a proportion variable. So for example, if we have we can have 100 or 3,500 experiments as we had in our synthetic experiments, and we see this histogram, which is a distribution over possible final states. And in the end, there could be any number of surviving bees or any number of successful agents, which means for a population of size n, we have n plus 1 possible outcomes ranging from 0 to n. And so we encode each of these outcomes as one proportional variable. So we want to that the probability of finally globally reaching I is within the interval that we infer from data. And of course, so we actually want to conjunct this property for each possible outcome, because in this way we are encoding everything we see in the distribution. And this distribution, as I can show in some backup slides, it can, depending of course on the function Q, it can also be quite irregular. So it's really not possible always to approximate it with some well-known distribution. And we are being very agnostic here. So we are assuming any possible, actually for the categorical variables, it's a Dirichlet distribution. And then when we encode this, we obtain reachability for final components symbolically as rational functions over the variables. And I put this in the brackets because actually there is a method that also skips this step and directly does the region generation and splitting. But for our case, we were able to do this, and there are other applications where other things we can do with this, in our case, polynomials. So that's why I actually show it. So these rational functions that characterize reaching some steady states are, in our case, polynomials. And those would be all the paths that lead to some state. There is an algorithm from 2004 that does it in a polynomial time. And it is supported by probabilistic model checkers, Prism and Storm. And actually, for example, for 20 agents, finally globally reaching 10 successes would be this huge expression that if we were doing just inspection without automatizing this process, it would be quite hard to understand. So we can recast our reachability query to the kind of an interval arithmetic problem. So our property will be satisfied. So the conjunction of these reachability queries is satisfied exactly when these polynomials over the variables are within some intervals. And then the step three is the region generation and splitting with an SMT solver. So for those who don't know what SMT solvers or SATs, SMT solvers are, it's a very powerful technology that was designed originally just for finding the satisfiability of Boolean formula in the SAT case. And SMT stands for satisfiability modulo theories, which means you can also reason about some for other theories like linear arithmetics. This is a book where one can find quite a nice introduction to these techniques. In our case, I will show how this works, just assuming that we are now in the middle of our coloring, and let's say that this is the current coloring, and we are now looking at this region. And actually what this SATs or SMT solver gives us, we can ask whether the property holds in this whole region. And the trick is that we actually work with property negations rather than the property itself, or one can complement the two as well. But if the property negation is not satisfiable in the whole current region, then we color the whole region green. And if the property negation is valid, so it holds in the whole region, then we can color it red. And if neither of these two hold, then we have to split the region. And so we, for example, here we see that the property is valid, then maybe we move to the other region, and then that one we have to split. And here you already see that there is some art into choosing which region is next, and also how you split your space, because this will influence largely the performance of the algorithm. So if it's a very unclever encoding, one can keep splitting in some uninteresting area. But if it's a clever encoding, it will find the big red portions or big green portions of space very quickly. And this is what actually Matej, who is here in the audience, obtained with the, it's a dummy example to show how the splitting further works to find, for example, this parameter space. So we have this blue white region here somewhere at the boundary between the red and green. And Matej implemented this workflow, and actually we first tried if the existing state-of-the-art model checkers support these queries, Prism and Storm namely. But it turned out that, for example, for generating polynomials, Prism worked better. Storm was efficient, more efficient in general, but it doesn't support multiple properties. So in the end, Matej implemented three versions of his own algorithm for doing the region generation and splitting. So we have a fully automated workflow in Python with the dependencies on Prism and Z3. And this would be the general workflow. So now from the talk, one may recognize some of the keywords here. Like this would be a parametric Markov chain for n agents. I didn't mention this by simulation equivalency. It's accounting abstraction on the population state. Then here it's the region generation and splitting part. And this is some example This is just for two parameters to show how it works, how it actually, what the tool outputs, and it's pretty nice. So we can see that for, of course, if we have a smaller sample size, our for a given confidence, we will have more parameters that satisfy the property. And the more sample size we have for the same confidence, we will have our green area will be smaller. So this is actually for the two case example, one can even obtain the analytic expression of what happens. So it's not the most interesting one. But as we go to more dimensions, the problem explodes and the method becomes less scalable. So this would be some benchmarks that we can discuss later on with whom is interested. And as conclusions, very briefly, so we I presented a framework for parameter synthesis for population parametric discrete Markov chains for multiple temporal properties inferred from data at steady state. The fact that these are multiple temporal properties, it seems it's actually a novel challenge even for the probabilistic verification community, as the tools that we tried don't support this query. So it opened up the challenge also for general probabilistic verification questions. Then again to mention that here we can fully discard or accept immediately fully entire parameter regions. And this is the major advantage with the other techniques for parameter inference or regression. Then the obtained rational functions, in our case polynomials, we can also explore further. For example, they will give us exact priors for doing the Bayesian inference, like Metropolis Hastings, for example. And the downside is that scalability, as the population size grows, is not satisfactory yet. So for future works, one of the immediate things for improving the current tool is the scalability, so to do some pre-sampling and to try different measures for encoding the property from data. And then, of course, in the application for finding out how the social feedback in honeybees works out, there we want to actually do the model selection between several hypotheses on the function Q. And that we hope it's going to be tractable. And there are very interesting theoretical following works for this. For example, the Gaussian approximation analysis for large n's, so that we see if there is some phase transition on the scale process. And as I mentioned, supporting the multi-state, supporting also the multi-state final components. So if it's not a single steady state, but several states, like a dynamic steady state. And of course, in further future work, we would like also to incorporate time series measurements when they would be available and to have a model including continuous time. And of course, the control experiments. And this, I just put several projects in the lab that are not, the top two are actually about what I talked now here. Then with the similar techniques, we try to answer, do genetic circuits memorize events different than electronic ones? As there is a widely believed hypothesis, and in which way? Then on rule-based modeling, language and its analysis, and theoretically about algorithms for deciding equivalence between two probabilistic models of computation, especially interesting in a black box setup when we don't know anything about the system. We can just observe the input-output relationships, or the model minimization that is related. And that if you have met Stefano Tugnazzi, who is coming as a postdoc, he has experience already, and he will work also on the on model reduction. And as a side project, yeah, with Dennis, who hopefully will get the visa and come again, we're also doing so-called deep abstractions for reaction-based models, where we embed the continuous time Markov chain describing the biochemical reactions into the discrete space of such a continuous time Markov chain. We embed into a continuous space, and then one can learn the kernel of transitions very efficiently. Thanks a lot for attention. I'm sorry for going a bit over the time.
Like, what does it mean now for application? Like, you mentioned this kind of B-defense modeling. So what does that mean to how many individuals and to what kind of states you can go and really apply these models?
The method? Yeah, the method, I think the best we got is up to 10, which is quite bad. But I'm really hopeful, and it's also reasonable to hope when we phrase it as a model selection model, model selection problem, and we make some assumption on this function Q of I, then it will have a fixed number of parameters, like 4 parameters for any number of agents, and then it should scale. Because this is really too agnostic on that function.
The more individuals you take, it explodes exponentially in the parameter space, and that limits your individuals very much. Or
no, actually, the number of parameters is exactly equal to the number of individuals, which already is a huge problem, because for 20 individuals you have 20 parameters. This is really just preliminary work in the direction. We wanted to see how the state-of-the-art tools, when we interconnect them, would perform. And now, some hypothesis on the function will probably make a difference.
Maybe bring up again the slide where you're showing this one. Okay, so checking problem with the red area, right? Have you ever looked into using something like statistical model checking or Monte Carlo sampling in order to figure out what the red area is? I mean, I like this SMT based approach, much more elegant. But maybe such a group like Monte Carlo simulation of that could help us, right?
Yeah, so I show you. No, this is the one. What's nice really with this polynomials, we have an exact prior for doing the MCMC. So this is, for example, what we would get with Metropolis-Hastings. The thing is that here you get the distribution of our parameters, so what is more or less likely. But we don't know for sure for certain. So what could be a problem if there is some small region, green region also here, then the statistical methods wouldn't find it. I mean, maybe they would have a harder time finding it.
But if you do on this two-dimensional space, which is what you grant in that case, if you do a Monte Carlo sampling on that, I mean, if you equally distribute where you pick the sample, why would you not find, I'm not sure I understand that.
We can discuss more into technicalities. It's it's a very technical argument. And actually, we were looking at that. And the first step we will try with this pre-sampling that I mentioned. So one naive way to do pre-sampling is just to grid pre-sampling. And an improved, better way, of course, is to do the Bayesian sampling, so to like Markov chain Monte Carlo. But still, the combination of the two probably is the best.
So when you talk about the problem of upscaling, and then you want to solve that by pre-sampling, how do you find out whether your pre-sampling led you into a local minimum and you lost the real minimum of your function?
That's exactly what would be the answer to Stefan's question before. Yes, so if one does pre-sampling with the statistical methods, one can get stuck in some minimum or maximum. For example, if that is one part of the region, and one would not see that maybe somewhere far away there is a better point, or there are some more green points. So that is exactly where the SAT solvers will tell us, because they will discard the region only if the entire region is red.
You were just talking about this, so I'm trying to understand really this between Bayesian inference, which if you have the probability parameter given the data, or just typical sensitivity analysis where you use the Hessian or the Fisher information to then see how sensitive your output is to a certain parameter, versus the parameter synthesis, and particularly if this, so with like n interacting agents and you have many parameters, like Bayesian inference just becomes not possible because with something like MCMC. So would you expect to get possibly a better at least scaling with n using this?
No, actually it's going to be worse. I mean, actually I don't know if, because that's one of the experiments we want to check. But in general, this is the kind of approach that gives you stronger guarantees. So it's going to scale worse in general.
Okay, so that the difference is more in what is being said about the output.
And so but the difference to your first question, the difference between the inference or point estimates of parameters is the objective function. There you have the objective function which you want to minimize or maximize, and you find a single point that gives you, or you can find more points, but that are at the smallest distance to your with respect to your objective function. Where here you have the property. So it's a different, so the property is satisfied or not. So it's this interplay between a decision problem, that is a problem that has answers yes or no, or optimization problem that gives you some quantity of what is the best outcome with respect to some objective function.
Perhaps I miss a basic point, but you say that you use the data in the steady state.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you know, or what are criteria that you know that you are in steady state?
Okay, this is a good question. Why we did it is because Morgan had steady state measurements, and she was sure that bees after 5 minutes, if I'm not wrong, they...
Yeah, we did some experiments with longer time scales, and everything happens within the first minutes of the test, and so that's the time we took. So we know there is nothing more happening there.
But this is exactly one of the things I'm, like in other projects as well, I'm doing as a research question, because it's actually a hard problem. And one of the results is if you have these black box observations, if you know, if you have a lower bound on each of your transitions probabilities, then you will know when you reach the steady state. Then you can give a bound on the time until when you should look at the system and be sure that what you see seems to be the steady state is really the steady state. But at least it's not then pure black box technique, so you need to have at least the assumption, which in biological systems it's a reasonable, at least in I worked on that in context of gene regulation, it's reasonable that there's some physical lower bound on some rates of binding rates or of molecules.